Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hi, everyone, and thank you for tuning in to the 121st episode of Awards Chatter, the Hollywood Reporter's awards podcast, presented by Walt Disney Animation Studios' hit original film Zootopia, which is Golden Globe nominated for Best Animated Feature. My guest today is a living legend. He is a trailblazer for actors of color, as the first black A-list movie star since Sidney Poitier, excepting Eddie Murphy. He is one of the most bankable movie stars of his time, with a filmography collectively responsible for more than $3.6 billion in box office sales worldwide. And he is both a Tony winner and a two-time Oscar winner. He is, of course, Denzel Washington. The 61-year-old began his illustrious career on the stage and the small screen, before making his name in a series of films that told race-related stories. A Soldier's Story in 1984, Cry Freedom in 1987, Glory in 1989, for which he won his first Oscar, and Malcolm X in 1992. In the mid-90s, he began to paint on an even broader canvas, with major parts in 1993's Philadelphia and the Pelican Brief, opposite Tom Hanks and Julia Roberts, respectively, 1995's Crimson Tide, the first of five action movies that he would make over 15 years with Tony Scott, and 1999's The Hurricane, a controversial biopic. And in the years since, he's tended towards darker characters in films like 2001's Training Day, for which he won his second Oscar, 2007's American Gangster, and 2012's Flight, all while periodically returning to the stage, Broadway specifically, most notably in 2005's Julius Caesar, 2010's Fences, for which he won the Best Actor in a Play Tony, and 2014's A Raisin in the Sun. Washington's latest film, the third that he's both directed and starred in, after 2002's Antoine Fisher and 2007's The Great Debaters, is an adaptation of Fences, based on a screenplay written by the theatrical production's legendary playwright, the late August Wilson. For his work as a director and as an actor, Washington is once again the subject of great reviews and Oscar buzz. Over the course of a two-part conversation, the first part recorded at the Four Seasons in Beverly Hills, and the second part at an office building in Century City, Washington and I discuss how his work as a YMCA camp counselor led him to pursue an acting career in the first place, what the advice was that he was offered early in his career by Poitier regarding how to select roles and how to conduct himself in public, what he learned from his repeat collaborations with Norman Jewison, Antoine Fuqua, and the late Scott, the important role that his faith plays in his life, his film selections, and in shaping the storylines of the films that he does agree to do, why he's skeptical about the whole Oscar So White controversy, and what the immense challenges and rewards were of bringing Fences from a stage to a screen. So without further ado, let's go to that conversation. Mr. Washington, thank you so much for doing this. We always begin by asking, where were you born and raised, and what did your folks do for a living?
I'm born and raised in Mount Vernon, New York, which is a suburb just outside New York City. In fact, my street that I grew up on, across the street from my house, was the Bronx. Mm-hmm. My side was Mount Vernon, across the street was the Bronx. My mother worked in a beauty parlor, and my father worked for the Department of Water and they didn't call it water and power, but he worked for the water department in New York.
And also a minister, right?
And a minister. And he worked it. He's only had a lot of Troy in him, I guess. He had a night job. He worked for S. Kleins. He was the late night guard or whatever. He worked for the water department, and he was a minister.
And were you close with your parents? The reason I ask, obviously, is it will tie in with Fences when we come to that.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And the one thing that I found interesting just reading past interviews and things that you've done was that your father was not that big on you going to the movies, right?
Because of the religious aspect of it. You know, King of Kings, Ten Commandments, all good. Not so much. I mean, I don't remember, like, no, you can't. First of all, it costs money.
Yeah.
Let's start there.
Right.
Yeah, it costs money.
And so the alternative was that you and your friends kind of created your own entertainment. I read about your first time sort of performing maybe around 7 or 8 with a friend. Is that true?
Yeah. You know, when I was 6, I joined, in those days it was called the Boys Club. Mm-hmm. So I joined the Boys Club because one was built on the south side of Mount Vernon. And we had a talent show. It was actually Ludacris, Chris Bridges. You know Ludacris?
Yeah, of course.
It was his dad. Ah. Wayne Bridges and I were friends. And Wayne and I, we acted like we were the Beatles. We ran a little talent show.
And that was the first.
And that was the end of my music career.
Yeah, right. So. As I understand it, your parents got divorced. You maybe started misbehaving a little bit, acting out a little bit. And then your mother was sort of the one that really stepped in and gave you some direction. Is that fair to say?
That's not bad. But yeah. I mean, when they got divorced, I lived with my mother.
Yeah.
When you're a boy and a teenager and there's no man in the house, you know, the streets can take over. And just like what's happening today, unfortunately, the streets was my, you know, the streets were my father. What did they say? The streets was, I read something that said the streets are your father and the judge is your mother. That wasn't the case for me because I never had to go before the judge, but my 3 closest friends did.
They did.
Yeah.
How did you avoid it in a way that they couldn't? What was the secret?
There was no secret. My mother had enough sense to get me out of town and sent me away to you know, she scrounged up enough money, sent me away to private school.
Private school.
Yeah.
And also
where the real criminals were.
right.
Yeah, man. I was like, oh, they got the good stuff.
Yeah, right.
Yeah,
right.
Man.
And then also summer camps and stuff. Is that where acting really took off?
Yes and no. What it was is I was flunking out by my sophomore year. And I had done a lot of work with kids, with boys in the Boys Club. And I had already taken one acting class, which I kind of like. And that summer, after getting thrown out, I got a job with the YMCA. And I worked at one of their camps. And then we did a little skit for the kids. And one of the guys were like, man, you ever thought about acting? You know, you just seem good at it. But understand, I started pre-med. Then I went to political science. Then I went to journalism.
At Fordham.
So I didn't find what I was looking for in life. And that's why I told my kids, and I tell kids, hey, a liberal arts education is okay. You don't got to know at 18 what you're going to do the rest of your life.
Right.
But I was actually working my way toward the arts without realizing it. I went from pre-med to pre-law to journalism to theater.
I read about Othello being a big thing for you at Fordham. Is that?
Yeah. That's where that, and I did another play, Eugene O'Neill's The Emperor Jones, and I found out I had ability, and people were saying, you know, but because of what I learned in the Boys Club, which was your natural ability will only take you so far. That's what they would teach us. I knew my natural ability would only take me so far. Let me tell you an interesting story. So I decided I'm going to go to graduate school and study more. There was Juilliard, SMU, this one, that one. Well, I saw the American Conservatory Theaters production of Taming of the Shrew was on PBS. Mm-hmm. And then they did a special about their training program and all that. And I'm like, man, San Francisco, that might as well have been Mars. I was like, I wonder, they're good. So I ended up, I got in. I got a full scholarship. I got a full scholarship. I think it was full scholarship to ACT. That was 39 years ago.
Wow.
I get to San Francisco the night before I'm supposed to register. I had saved up $800. I stayed at the Sheraton Palace Hotel, which was $35 a night. So I knew I had to get out of there quick. I said, and I knew, because I'm from New York, I know how to hustle.
Right.
I said, I'd get a job in a restaurant so I can eat for free. The restaurant, it was called Salmagundi's 31 Soups, and they were right next to ACT, which was the theater program. Well, across the street was the Curran Theater and the Geary Theater. Mm-hmm. The Curran Theater was where the big Broadway shows would come in. At that time, The Wiz was there. A couple of guys, one in particular guy named Ben Harney, used to come in. He liked to come in early before the show, and I'd clean his table, do whatever, and he'd say, I see a young man, he didn't know me from a hole in the wall. And I'd watched him go across the street. I said, man, one day I'm gonna play in that theater, and I'm gonna get in there and be like him. 39 years later, last night, they had the premiere, and it didn't hit me until I turned the corner. I said, oh, that's right, it's right across the street. I told that story up on the stage. It took me 39 years.
You've been busy. I've been busy.
Exactly. Thank you. You understand.
Of course. So you started to really get a good response in the theater. Even after ACT, I'm reading about the New York Shakespeare Festival and then right. some of the off-Broadway stuff, the play that won the Pulitzer and inspired Soldier Story years later. But did you always aspire to have a screen career? Or was it? Would you have been happy to be a theater actor?
Well, no, we were snobs. We screen career. No, yeah. we're going to do Shakespeare right. and make $650 a week on Broadway.
Right.
Yeah, that's just the way. See, you know, I guess because it wasn't like a dream as a child. My dream was to play football.
Right.
You know, but it wasn't a dream. So it wasn't like I was always, oh, I got to get to Hollywood. It wasn't like that at all. I just sort of found my way to acting. Then I found I was pretty good at it. Mm-hmm. But I started in the theater, so I thought that's what it was. And then also, I lived in New York. This was mid-70s. And they had movies like Mean Streets and Taxi Driver. And I was like, I like those kind of movies, that kind of acting. When it came to theater, James Earl Jones was the king as far as for an African-American. I saw lots of plays, but James Earl Jones was like, he had done a play, and I kind of snuck backstage, really. And he, again, he knew me from Adam. And he could see I was curious. Right. And he said, you're not? I said, yeah, yes, sir. And he said, well, you can look around, you know. I said, okay. He said, don't touch anything. I said, yes, sir. So he had his rings and everything. Right. I'm trying on the rings, and he's the people are talking to him. And I'm like, man, again, one day.
Now, the amazing thing is, what was that play?
That wasn't Fences.
It wasn't?
Nah.
Okay. All right.
That was Oedipus the King.
Okay. All right.
I'll bring you to Fences right. now. In 87 or 6, whenever I saw it on Broadway.
Oh, okay.
I'm closer to Corey's age.
Yes. Yeah.
So I'm not thinking about, oh, one day I'll be Troy.
Right.
I'm Corey. And plus, I'm 29 or 30, whatever. I'm not thinking like that. I'm like, I'll never be that old.
Right.
You know what I mean? You know, when you're young. So when Scott Rudin brought me the screenplay 7 years ago, and I read it, I said, you know, I never read the play. But I'm remembering that performance with James. So I read it, and it said Troy Maxson, 53. And I was 55. I'm like, well, I better hurry up. So I called Scott Rudin, the co-producer, and I, and told him I want to do the plays.
So going backwards, though, how does a guy who had no interest in a screen career wind up in one? It was the key first thing that you got an agent?
No. The key was the first thing was that I was introduced to theater. Mm-hmm. In my humble opinion, that's where you learn how to act. Mm-hmm. Some of the greatest actors of our time are from the theater. The most highly decorated actor of our time probably is Meryl Streep, mm-hmm. Juilliard.
Yeah.
It was right across the street from me.
Right.
Not that did anything rubbed off, but it was. I could see it anyway.
Right.
Stephen Henderson, who's in our film now, Juilliard.
Right.
You know, so.
So you're doing theater though, but what led to that to those first film opportunities? I guess really the first film opportunity was 81 Carbon Copy.
Right.
Then you had your unexpected foray into TV. Right, while doing movies. How do you end up in a movie for the first time?
In between that, I shot Carbon Copy in 1980. Came out in 81. I went back to New York. We came out here and shot in California. Came back to New York. And I was looking to get back on stage. May of 81, I get a play called When the Chickens Came Home to Roost, which is about Malcolm X and Elijah Muhammad. Did the play. Great success. Like gangbusters. Douglas Turner Ward, who ran the Negro Ensemble Company, had seen me do it and asked me if I wanted to play this part of Peterson in a new play called The Soldier's Play. So When the Chickens Came Home to Roost led to A Soldier's Play, which led to the movie, A Soldier's Story. While we're running A Soldier's Play, two actors from New York got jobs on the TV show called St. Elsewhere, David Morse and myself. And that was my first foray into really television. And my agent at the time, Ruth Aronson, God rest his soul, she's like, no, this one, you know, because we didn't want to really do a lot of TV, but she said it's 16 characters, it's quality stuff. What is it, Hill Street Blues at the hospital.
Yeah.
And I came out here for a 13-week job that lasted 35 years.
Yeah, right. Six.
Yeah.
So, but the reason you didn't want to do TV was you had this idea even that early on that if you're going to do screen acting, film is the place to be.
No, I can't take credit for that. Ruth Aronson, my agent saw that.
Yeah.
I just want to eat.
Right.
Yeah, I'm not going to sit here and tell you that lie.
Right.
I just wanted to eat. But she saw something in me that she was saying, I need to wait. I need to, you know, but then she felt, no, I think she was gone before St. Elsewhere. My next agent, it may have already been Ed LaMotto.
Ed LaMotto.
I think she passed.
And so Ed LaMotto ended up being a very big figure in your life, right? Mm. I mean, why you think he would have been the person saying, you know, focus on film?
Let me tell you how small the world is.
Yeah.
Ed LaMotto's from Mount Vernon. Ed LaMotto's father built the house I grew up in.
No way. That's unbelievable.
So we had that connection already.
Yeah.
Ruth, who had passed away, but before when I first signed with her, she introduced me to Ed, and he had this big star named Richard Gere. You know, and I think another young guy was coming up named Gibson. I'm like, all right, he's doing all right.
Right. He's a good guy to be with.
Yeah, he's a good guy to be with.
So one other thing that I got to ask you about is that, you know, who were your models? Because there obviously weren't, prior to you, many A-list African-American actors. And so the one that jumps to mind, of course, is Sidney Poitier. And I understand that you had met him early on and that he had two very interesting pieces of advice, one of them about just how you should select projects, but also about how you should...
see you for free all week?
Yeah, so tell me about that, because that's amazing. That's a fast, and you've really abided by that. So well, if you could share what he had to, how you met him, and then what he had to say about selecting projects and also how you appear in public.
First, it was really James, because it was theater first for me. I didn't even know why I got into it, because they said I was pretty good at it.
Yeah.
So now I'm studying it, and I'm digging theater, and I'm 20, I'm in college. I'm just studying acting. But now I'm starting to learn about acting, and they would take you go to see plays all the time. It wasn't like we were going to see movies. We weren't. You would be taken to see plays. So it developed that way. That's what was instilled in me before I knew I needed to make any decisions. Now, Sidney was in California. I didn't meet Sidney until he came to see A Soldier's Play.
So he saw the play.
He saw the play in 81 or early 82, because I left by April of 82. And he said, hey, young man, you're good. You're good.
What did that mean to you?
What do you think? Sidney Poitier.
Yeah.
So I knew I had something because people were telling me.
Yeah.
But it wasn't like I was aspiring to be him, because I wasn't.
Yeah.
Not to say it wasn't my thing. It's just... And you know, I don't say slowing down. You know, the 70s, he started doing more of the comedies, actually.
Prior stuff.
Yeah. And again, we were just theater snobs. We were trained to be snobs. This was the theater.
And was it during that initial encounter that he offered these pieces of advice?
No. He didn't lay it all on me then. It was things happened over time, because when he told me the first four or five movies you make will determine how you proceed, that was already 1986.
So you'd already done a couple.
Yes. I had done A Soldier's Story. I had done Power.
Yeah.
I hadn't done Cry Freedom, because when he told me that, I turned the movie down that I wasn't feeling good about. He said, and to his credit, he didn't tell me to turn it down. He said, but, you know, your first four or five films will be how you perceive. And first of all, he said, look, this is the way you feel. If something's not going to make you feel good. To make a long story long, I turned it down. 6 months later, I got Cry Freedom, which was my first.
So which had you turned down? You had turned down Cry Freedom?
No. I don't mention the one I turned down, because fair to
those. But there was a different one that you had turned down.
Yeah, it was a bit of a different one.
But in a sense then, you were already, before he ever told you, be careful, you know, about your first projects, your first three movies, if we're excluding
Carbon Copy. Power.
Well, no, Soldier
Story and Power.
Power.
So I had done those three when he told me
But
that.
But that's, so, I mean.
Yeah, but I hadn't. You know, go
Norman
ahead.
Jewison,
yeah,
Sidney Lumet,
yeah,
and then with Cry Freedom, Richard Attenborough. That's a way to start your career.
But it was going to be Norman Jewison, Sidney Lumet, and
somebody
the
else.
Other guy, exactly. Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
So I hear you. And
no, they never made the movie.
Oh, it didn't even get done.
No.
Okay, and then the second thing that he said though is, I really don't want to let go, because I think you are one of the few people who have managed to be a major movie star in this era without people knowing all that much about you off screen. And I just wonder, this seems to maybe stem from that other piece of advice.
If they see you for free all week, they won't pay to see you on the weekend?
Yes.
That, and I'm not a celebrity. I'm an actor. See me where? I'm not a professional go out and be seen. I don't have to open department stores and, you know, that's not what I do for a living. I'm an actor.
But how do so many other people that see themselves as actors get stuck in that?
What did you just say? That see themselves?
Yeah, they're not.
Well, I'm not saying that they're not.
Yeah.
I'm just saying what it was for me.
Right.
Everybody finds their way there. And celebrity is different than acting.
Mm-hmm.
Stardom is different than acting. See, the foundation was laid down for me the right way. the first information that I got about acting was about theater, right, and learning about Eugene O'Neill and Arthur Miller and Tennessee Williams and Shakespeare. That was my introduction.
But clearly you had discipline as well. Not everybody can stick to that.
I didn't even know any better. You know, because of the training, because of the way I came into the business as a theater actor, that's what I wanted. I enjoyed that. And maybe because there weren't any, no, even with the movies, there were movies I wanted to be like. I wanted to do De Niro or Pacino or Hoffman. Mm-hmm. That was all going on. I liked all of that. Now, either I was too stupid or I didn't realize, well, they're not making any like that with you and MD. You know, but between whatever it was when I graduated, 78 and St. Elsewhere in 82, mm-hmm, I got jobs. Mm-hmm. When I got St. Elsewhere, between St. Elsewhere and what Sidney told me in 86, I was working.
Well, yeah. So, and you were doing all of these early movies that we talked about, Soldier, mm-hmm, Story, Power, Cry
and
Freedom.
And St. Elsewhere.
So on hiatuses from, mm-hmm, the one that I want to ask you about is Cry Freedom, because I understand that that one meant extra to you in a sense because you actually went to Africa to shoot this. That was a big thing. And also, though, kind of amazingly for anyone who saw you in that, it didn't necessarily change everything right afterwards, right?
Who said it's supposed to?
Well, but when you do good work, you would think it gets appreciated,
wouldn't
you?
It did get appreciated. I got an Academy Award nomination.
Of course, but you said also that I didn't get 20 offers right after Cry Freedom. I got one for The Mighty Quinn. That was it.
But I was also doing St. Elsewhere.
So you were fine.
Yeah, I was working.
Okay.
Yeah. I was working. I was eating.
Yeah.
You know, I was commuting from Africa. I was commuting from Zimbabwe.
Yeah.
To L.A. I was shooting episodes of St. Elsewhere while I'm shooting Cry Freedoms. Mm-hmm. So whenever I said that quote, I must have been in a funky mood. You know, no. You know, I was working. I didn't get 20 offers, but yeah. Who said I was supposed to?
Right. So the next big one would have been Glory, 89, 2 years later. After
let's see, Mighty Quinn. Mighty Quinn in 87. Then in 88, I think it was an actor's strike. So I went back to Broadway. I did a play on Broadway. While I was on Broadway with Paul Winfield and Ruby Dee.
Yeah.
While I was on Broadway, Ed Zwick came to town having auditions for Glory.
And so you got that by auditioning?
Yeah. How else are you going to get
it? Well, I don't know.
Hey, here's the part? They were still, you had to win the part. So actually what happened was there were two parts and they said Andre Brower played the other one. And they asked me which one I wanted to do. And Mary Cahoon, who was the casting agent, said, no, play Trip. I said, why? I said, I wasn't sure either. I was either going to do the one Andre ended up doing or Trip. She said, why Trip? She said, because you play a doctor and you're, but this is so different. That's why I did it, because the casting agent, Mary Cahoon, suggested it.
You may be sick of talking about this. I don't know. I hope it's not an annoyance to ask you, but the scene in Glory.
Oh, getting whipped?
Getting whipped, and then the single tear. I think that it probably sealed what was already an Oscar nomination worthy performance. Ended up being an Oscar winning performance. But I just wonder, what do you remember of shooting that? And did you realize that something special was going on in that sequence?
No, the job wasn't done. Yeah. You don't celebrate in the second quarter.
But
now they knew that. You know, plus who knew how the movie? We didn't know if the movie was going to be any good or not. I mean. I was too green to even know. I'm just trying to do my job as an actor. And like I said, it was only the second quarter that when we shot that. The movie, you know, nothing had come out. And when we went to Germany for the Berlin Film Festival with Glory, and I got this ovation, that's really when I knew, whoa.
It done good.
Yeah. In fact, we were in Germany in 1990, because I helped take a little piece of the wall down when the Oscar nominations came out.
Wow. And you had been nominated for Cry Freedom. Mm-hmm. You get another nomination for Glory. This is 2 in 3 years. Mm-hmm. But just...
Is that what it is? 2 in 3 years?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
So, to go back, though, just when that... Just because that clip will be played forever. Mm-hmm. How did you get to that place emotionally to do that scene?
Well, so we ain't got that much time. I'm an actor. That's what we do. You know, that's what I do. Yeah.
What did the Oscar mean to you? To win, and how did it affect things?
I mean, it was all good. I mean, I'm in the club.
Yeah.
Let me tell you, Cry Freedom. When I was up for the first one, Sean Connery was up for Untouchables.
Yeah.
I think.
Yeah.
where he came out to present something else first and got a standing ovation. I told my wife I'm going to go get the coats because it's over. Yeah, I ain't winning this one, you know.
But with Glory, did you feel it?
It was my turn.
Did you suspect that going in?
No, and even just as it relates to awards, remember, or I'll explain this. Mm-hmm. Soldier stories, people started telling me. But I was young and green. I didn't quite get in the club. Sort of like not to say he won't get in the club, but like where Jovan is now in our film.
Someone else got a nomination for that. Who was it that got it for?
Oh, Adolf Caesar. Yeah, Adolf Caesar. Yeah. So I'm like, well, good to know you're in the club.
Right.
Okay. Then by Cry Freedom, you know, I get the nod and everything. It's all good. It's all fresh. It's all new. Well, I didn't win. I said, yeah, but I got a free suit. You know, I'm going to Governor's Ball, get some of these shrimps and stuff they got in there. How bad is it? Ma, you want that centerpiece? Right. Or take that flower arrangement home? This, what a business. And we got a limo.
Right.
How bad is it, really?
It's pretty good.
Right, right. So then by Glory, you see, it was a process. Yeah. It was Soldier Story, Cry Freedom, Glory. And in this business, sometimes you have to wait your turn. You know, right now, it's Viola Davis's turn. You know, when I was up nominated for Malcolm X, it was Al Pacino's 8th, I think, nomination. I'm like, man.
Because you said you voted for him on that,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, I mean, how can Al Pacino
not have an Oscar,
go, yeah, 0-7?
Yeah.
I was already 1-2.
Right.
Yeah.
But speaking of Malcolm X, you, after Glory, did 2 movies with Spike in 3 years. That was Mo Better Blues and then Malcolm X.
Okay.
And I just wonder, did you know him before? Did you hit it off with him?
He came to see me in Checkmates, I think it was, in 88. And that's where we met. And he he showed me a rough cut. He showed me a cut. I don't know how rough it was, but he showed me a cut of Do the Right Thing. And he talked about this jazz movie he wanted to do. And he was Spike Lee.
Yeah.
And I'm like, when do we start?
Yeah, right. Now, one thing that came up around those years, it's interesting. I mean, it really was crystallized by Do the Right Thing. I think not getting a Best Picture nomination and the Oscar that year, going to Driving Miss Daisy, which Spike is still ticked off about. The fact, though, is that movies around that time, including Cry Freedom and Glory, if they were going to deal with race, more often than not, they tended to be
through the eyes of the white guy.
Yes.
Yeah, it was a different time. Looks like those days are over. I'm trying to think of a movie. None that I've been in.
No, that's it. No, but that was why Malcolm X must have felt pretty good, because originally, that, I believe, was supposed to be Norman Jewison directing, and then Spike ends up directing it, and it's got to be a totally different thing in a way. Not that Norman Jewison...
He did pretty good with Soldier Story.
And In the Heat of the Night, and many, you know. But do you feel, and this will come back up again with Fences, do you think that when the subject matter deals with, to some extent, the African-American experience...
I've said this, and I'll say it here.
Yeah.
It's culture as much as it is race. Mm-hmm. Scorsese could have directed Schindler's List. Spielberg could have directed Goodfellas. Mm-hmm. But nobody talks, that's not race, that's cultural.
Right.
You know, it's, who knows the Italian-American culture better than Scorsese? But Spielberg could have done it. Who knows that the Jewish-American experience, the Holocaust experience, better than Spielberg? But Scorsese could have done it.
Sure.
So it's culture, you know, it's so easy just to use the word race.
Right.
When sometimes it's culture.
It's interesting, though, that do you think it would have been in any way a different movie had it been Jewison versus Spike?
Man, listen, they're both great filmmakers, and there's room for both of them.
Yeah.
We don't have to choose. Spike went and grabbed the bull by the horn, whatever, and took it, and God bless him. Go do your thing.
That performance for you, I heard that you kind of referenced your own father because he would preach too, right?
Yeah, yeah.
What was it, the cadence, or what was it?
Yeah, it comes from that tradition. You know, it wasn't like I was playing my dad or anything, but it comes from that tradition. And I had the luxury of all those Malcolm X albums, and so I just play him, and I got to know him so well, I could talk about anything. I talk about this black thing. He says, see, the black man, we're the basis of the table. The white man stitches his life through ours, and he tries to intertwine and take over. Why is it he speaks through us, just like you and I are sitting here speaking through this black speaker? You know, he just, you know, and then all the time, the white man standing right behind you with that light shining on you. You know, when he knew the doctrine, he could stick to the doctrine.
We were talking earlier about how Sidney Poitier gave you some advice about picking your early roles carefully, strategically.
Right.
Have you continued to think that way or very strategically since then? I came across a quote about the two movies that you did in 93, Philadelphia and The Pelican Brief, and you said, quote, "I could see the difference in my career as a result of those two films. There's a lot of people who would never go see Malcolm X or Cry Freedom or Soldier Story, but they'll go see Julia Roberts and Tom Hanks, and they see me and they say, well, he's good too." Talk about just the thought process about growing your audience.
Right. Well, it wasn't a plan.
Yeah.
I got those parts. It wasn't like, I think I'll join Julia. Maybe I'll join Tom. You know, no. They came to me and I said yes.
Yeah.
But in retrospect, it was a good 1-2 punch because, what was that, 93. Mm-hmm. So I'm trying to think. Well, Malcolm X I had done.
Yep.
Well, Gloria I had done.
Mm-hmm.
But they were at the height of their commercial powers. What was Tom? No, he hadn't done Forrest Gump yet.
Not yet.
But he was coming. You know, he was doing good. They were good. They were both great two-handers.
For sure. Yeah. For Philadelphia, you and Hanks, I think the objective assessment would be that you were co-leads. He, however, went on to the Oscars, got nominated, and won in lead. Some had urged you to go in the supporting category, but Ed LaMotto had a quote there, "Denzel is not a supporting actor."
Is that what he said?
Yeah.
Okay.
Do you remember that?
I don't remember the quote.
Right.
But that was his attitude. And I was really, I was fine with whatever. So we went for the acting and didn't get it.
No, the only reason I even mention it is that I just wondered if it's, again, from a strategic point of view, I could see how that would undermine the perception.
I wasn't as strategic.
No.
I just listened to his advice then.
Right.
You know, and I mean, I don't know what the page count was or the word count, but I trusted Ed, and I was like, "You think so?" He says, "I know so." I said, "Okay,
all right. Not long after those two movies in 93, you started what ended up being, a 15-year run and 5 movies with Tony Scott. And first being Crimson Tide,
mm-hmm.
and then, of course, Man on Fire, Deja Vu, Taking Pelham 1-2-3, and Unstoppable. And early on in your career, I was going back and trying to find these early interviews, and at one point you were not so high on the idea of action thriller-type movies. Obviously, your mind was changing. You made some really good ones, but do you remember the thought process about why you first got involved with Tony in those movies?
They were good scripts.
Yeah.
And there was 10 years almost between the two.
Yeah.
Crimson Tide was a good script. He had great writing. In fact, Tarantino wrote some scenes, and Robert Towne, I think, and some others. And it was really a good script, and he was good director. And Gene Hackman.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, that. And... But there was 10 years between that or 9 years between that, Man on Fire.
And are you as at home in the action thriller genre as you are in a drama? Do you feel just as comfortable?
I'm an actor.
I'm
an actor.
But it's not.
But it's not just the genre. That's not what drew me to it. Tony Scott called me. That's what drew me to it. It wasn't like, oh, I got to go find an action thriller genre right now. Tony Scott called you and said, "I got a script that I'm doing." And, you know, he had come off of Top Gun or whatever else he had done at that time. He says, you know, he did Top Gun and he has a good script and Gene Hackman wants to do it.
That's not a hard
one. Yeah, that's like, I don't know about the action genre. I don't know. So, but it was really, as it ended up, there's action, but our part of it was really like a play because we're in the sub the whole time. So it's the action outside and the bombs fly. I wasn't there for that part, you know, all the
for
sub
that
stuff.
One. Yeah. What was it that, you know, you took away from, I don't know if there's anyone else you've done 5 movies with. I don't think so. Based on that close collaboration with Tony and obviously the fact that he's now gone, what would you say you took away from those experiences with him?
He was just a genius with those cameras. Because we did Crimson Tide, then Man on Fire, it was like a drama in an action or whatever you call it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
He knew his part. I knew mine.
Yeah.
We worked well together.
I once heard you say, somebody said something like, if a person could only, for whatever reason, see one Denzel Washington movie, you ended up giving 2, but you said one of them would have been Man on Fire. Do you still feel that way? And
I don't know. I don't even know why I said that.
Yeah. Okay.
You know, I know my wife, one of her favorites was Crimson Tide. It might have had something to do with that.
Yeah.
Man on Fire was one of her, so maybe it has something to do with that.
Sure. Hurricane 99, was there ever a more physically challenging part that you had to play?
Yeah. Man, that was just boxing.
But, I mean, what talk about how you prepared
for
that.
Yeah, but I had already been boxing. I'd been boxing for 10 years but before.
Just for your own
person? No, I started boxing on Crimson Tide. So I've been boxing for 5 years because there's a scene where I throw the punches. So I found Mickey Ward.
Yeah, yeah.
Mickey had a gym, Wild Card gym, and because I wanted to look right throwing punches at the bag for Crimson Tide. And I signed up at Mickey's gym, and I met Freddie Roach, a great trainer, world champion. And then my guy, I've been with 22 years, Terry Claiborne. I worked out today, so I'm still sweating. It's just, you know, I hate one. So boxing is like strategic, and you learn, and you get better. And you, not that we're punching each other in the head. We don't do that, shoulders down. Mm-hmm. But you can continue to learn from it. So now it's a lifestyle.
Had you been looking for an outlet for that in the movies, or was that
just No, it was more basic trainers before. I just went to it because of Crimson Tide, and then I stayed with it. Now I've done other kinds of training as well, but before Crimson Tide, it was more the, like, say, for Ricochet, the weightlifting, running, and whatever.
That was a reunion with Jewison. You guys had done Soldier Story before and other, I think, maybe even one other. But my question is, that movie ended up kind of embroiled for reasons beyond anybody's control that was working on it, I guess, but in a bit of controversy. Do you feel that that was legitimate, the questions that came up about it and whatever about...
I'm not a lawyer, so what's legitimate mean?
Yeah.
You know, people got killed. So I respect their families and, you know, what they got to go through and all of that. So, and I don't know. You just know what people tell you.
Yeah.
So
you didn't have, you're not.
I didn't read the law, whatever. I didn't read the case.
But you spent some time with the real guy, right?
Yeah. And he says he was innocent and they say he's not.
Yeah. It's a, we'll never know.
Yeah. We'll never know.
So you've joked that for the first chunk of your career, you were biography man with Biko, Malcolm X, Hurricane, some of these others. Then after Training Day, you were for a little while, you say, bad guy man. You hadn't played many villains before Training Day. Why did you decide to play this guy?
It was an interesting script. And again, Ed LaMotto said, I went over to his house because we were looking for a director. The script came to us before the director. And he showed me Replacement Killers. We watched that, me, him, and my wife. I said, this kid can shoot. So what had developed over time was I learned script, development of script and all that, but I was working with great shooters, like, well, not a lot of them, but Tony.
Yeah.
So this kid, Antoine, I did my homework. He'd come out of Propaganda. He, Michael Bay, and Fincher, he could shoot. I said, well, I can act. He can shoot. And it felt like a good combination. And his ideas, it was more like a Lethal Weapon script. Guy with checkered shirt and beer bottles in the back. And Antoine's take was a whole gangster take. That was all brought by Antoine. And he introduced me to cops. He had so much, he was so prepared. I was like, this kid knows what he's doing.
Yeah.
So it was the perfect, it was, like with Tony, it was an excellent marriage.
In the doing of it, would you have ever imagined that this would or could result in Oscar number two?
No, absolutely not. Nope.
Just because that kind of a part, that kind of a movie wasn't normally their cup of tea?
I think people thought it was just such a stretch.
Yeah. So when that happened, what'd you make of it all? And on the night that Sidney Poitier got an honorary Oscar,
right. I made fun of it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do those mean something to you in the big picture? Do you feel, is it a, some people say, oh, you know, it's a doorstop or whatever. They put it in their bathroom. Yeah. How do you feel about
it? They didn't throw it out, though.
No.
I haven't seen any Oscar doorstops. Right. People say that. Who has said that?
Right.
And I've never seen it. Right. There's not a doorstop
not in your house. Yeah.
No, it's a tremendous honor, man. I mean, there's only so many people on that list, no matter what. And now I think, I may be wrong now, there were six men that have supporting an actor. I maybe have changed. Do you know if it's six?
I have to check.
I know it's De Niro, myself. I think it's Gene Hackman.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's Jack Lemmon.
And Nicholson.
Yeah, was that include me?
And you.
Yeah.
That's pretty good company.
What did I say? Nicholson, Hackman, De Niro, Lemmon, myself, and one other.
That's pretty amazing. Yeah. So what brought about the first time you directed was Antoine Fisher, 2002. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. How did that come about, and what did you make of the whole experience?
That's where I met Todd Black, where I'd met him before. He brought the script to me. He believed that I could direct. I wasn't thinking about directing. He probably brought me the script 5 years before we shot it, because I kept looking for reasons to get out of it. Training Day was one of them. I went and did Training Day. Then I went and did John Q. I think it was Training Day and John Q. He wanted me to direct Antoine Fisher.
Yeah.
But I kept taking other movies
to put it off. Yeah, yeah.
And Peter Rice, who ran, he was at Fox Searchlight, I think. Yeah. Right. He caught me, I think, with John Q. I think it was John Q. We were up in Toronto for the Toronto Film Festival, and I ran into him. And he has it still. You can find out. I signed a napkin saying, I will direct. I promise to direct. You can track him down.
Yeah, no,
I bet he still
awesome.
Has it.
I'm sure
I promise to direct Antoine Fisher. Now I'm like, oh, I'm in trouble now. Now I have to.
And doing it was a...
A panic.
Panic. It was more... Well, versus what you had expected it to be. How was it?
Well, that was why it was a panic, because you didn't know what to expect. You know, the difference between the difference in the 15 years, one of the big differences was, now I know what to worry about and what not to worry about.
Right, right.
You know, then I worried about everything.
Right.
I'm like, oh, I'm the director, so I got to know about everything. No, you don't. You got to put the best around you, mm-hmm. and you got to know what you know, and you know.
And we should say that in between Antoine Fisher and Fences was also The Great Debaters.
Right.
So obviously you weren't turned off by the experience of directing the first time.
I guess not.
But what, were you itching to do it again, or how did it work out the second time?
I wouldn't call it an itch. More like a sore. No. And I went back to Todd, and I brought that to him. I think it was Oprah Winfrey's company brought it to me, and I said, Todd, you know, help me on this. So I was better on that than I was on the first one. Or more better, more confident, more comfortable.
Why was The Great Debaters a story that you cared enough to tell that you would direct?
It was a good story, and it was just because it was a good story. I got to remember what I was doing around that time, too. See, it's interesting because people just watch the films. So they think, oh, he just gotten into action films. But I do plays. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So 2005, I did Julius Caesar. Mm-hmm. So sometimes I might go do an action picture and then go do Julius Caesar.
Just to mix it up.
Right. Yeah. So for me, my acting chops, it was action movie Julius Caesar.
Right, right.
Not... But the audience, the most of the people in the world see action picture. Yeah, but in between was Julius Caesar.
And so what year did you do Fences on Broadway?
Julius Caesar was 2005. Fences was 2010. And I did Raisin in the Sun.
I was there. I saw it. Oh, yeah. I loved it. Yeah.
And then I did Raisin in the Sun in 2014.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
So I'll go back again, maybe 14, maybe I already mentioned it. Scott Rudin, maybe 18 or 19.
Do you know what project?
Yeah. I don't know yet.
Yeah.
I don't know yet.
In between Antoine Fisher and Great Debaters was just a straight acting job, not directing, Frank Lucas in American Gangster.
Okay.
A movie that I think—
You said that was in between what and what?
I believe it's between—that's 2007. That's between the first two director jobs.
Right.
You know, one of your more memorable characters, Frank Lucas, you've met the actual guy.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
What did you make of that character?
He was a serious man. I mean, he's a serious murderer. You know, serious gangster, real serious gangster. Paid for his sins, but serious murderer.
And when you're playing a guy that you have no doubt that in this case that he did what he's accused of.
No, he didn't, I don't know about what he was accused of,
right.
But he did a lot of things.
Right.
I mean, he was Bumpy Johnson's driver and muscle man. And Bumpy Johnson ran Harlem for Dutch Schultz. So as Frank would say, I did what I was told. And sometimes it was dirty, but as he would always say, it was a dirty business. The heroin business is a dirty business. It's not like he killed the nice heroin man.
Right. Oh, man.
You know?
Well, so when one thing we haven't talked about is when you play somebody that's as dark a soul as Alonzo or Frank Lucas, they can say cut and you can go home and you know, have a pool party, or does it stay with you?
In Training Day, I wrote on a script, The Wages of Sin is Death. And the only thing I made them guarantee me is that he was going to die in the worst way. That way I could justify him living in the worst way. Mm-hmm. Frank Lucas, he comes out of jail alone, broken, nobody's there, little state government suit with his box. Mm-hmm. And that was the arc for me, that this is where you'll end up. Training Day, in this original script, you heard about it on television. that he had gotten killed, mm-hmm. as we saw Ethan Hawke's character going somewhere. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, nah, man, I can't. He's got to get blast because he's blasting everybody else. It's got to be equal.
And is the reason for that, because I appreciate the fact that for much of your life, and I believe up through now, you faith, religion has been a very big part
now,
of your
I don't want to use the word religion.
No.
That's what man uses.
Okay.
Religion goes, oh, yours religion is good. Yours is bad. Mine is good.
Right.
Faith and spirituality and belief. I like to use those words. But religion...
Gotcha.
That's what we put on it.
But the reason that I bring
yeah, that up, I'm always looking, not always, but I'm looking for a, you know, there's some kind of, what some redeeming
right,
spiritual
right.
Training day. That's why I wrote on the script, The Wages of Sin is Death.
Yeah.
When I started working on Fences, the play,
yeah.
I wrote From Hell to Hallelujah. Because one of the first things he says, oh, hell. And one of the last things he says is Hallelujah.
And so that's, you're doing that to highlight in your own mind.
Not that he became the good guy.
Right.
But he tried everything else, and look what you got.
It's just got to be that upward trajectory.
Yeah, but he was stuck on this thing about defeating death and defeating the devil, you know. And his wife tells him. And remember, when I covered him. You saw the movie?
Of course.
Yeah,
of course.
He covers his ears, yeah, yeah. and he doesn't want to see. You know.
Yeah.
That I look for that thread. I haven't been so without some kind of a payoff mm-hmm. or arc or change. I'm not just looking for the dark side. One of the biggest mistakes I made, I turned down 7 because it was so dark
yeah,
and
yeah.
evil.
The pit.
Worked out for, yeah, worked yeah. out, yeah, yeah. And as you can see, I was right. I didn't make any money. No, but good for him.
Yeah.
You've
okay. done okay without
I did
that.
All right.
Yeah.
I did all right. And actually, then when I saw the film, I was like, oh, it wasn't as bad as, it didn't play as bad as it read.
Right, right. One other morally conflicted, challenged guy, I guess you could say, would be your guy in Flight, yet another... nomination and another just fascinating character.
Right.
That must have been a kind of dark place to go to be that guy, right?
Well, I did a lot of research and there's a lot of stories. And it was another interesting arc. And the writer had been through it. He, and I'm not speaking out of turn. Mm-hmm. He turned his life around.
Yeah.
And I think I'm not speaking out of turn when I tell you Zemeckis had turned his life yeah. around. So you had two guys who'd been down that road. And it was a wonderful script. And my agent called and said, Zemeckis wants to do it. I start, you know,
yeah.
maybe the business side, not yeah. just the bit, forget business, but the I knew because they didn't want to make it for much money.
Yeah.
And I knew he knew that, but he still wanted to make it. I said, because if it had gotten too dark, 8 people would have seen it. It was, you know what I mean?
Right,
I said, oh, Zemeckis is interesting. Plus, he knew the landscape. And I said, he'll make, you know, like the upside down plane,
yeah.
all
oh
that stuff.
God, yeah.
And he did all that for like $30 million. I guess he called in all his favors or
yeah.
something. He made it feel bigger than.
Yeah, they don't even make many mid-range budget movies like that anymore.
He made
right?
a movie for 31 and it made it look.
Yeah.
So when I heard his name, just like an American Gangster, Antoine got fired or whatever, let go. And I didn't like it. And I just didn't like it.
Mm-hmm.
So there was, I don't know, maybe 2 years in between or 3.
Before Ridley.
Yeah. And then they called, the same thing as my point being, like yeah. Zemeckis, they said Ridley was, I said, what?
I'm back. Yeah.
No, I didn't say I'm back.
Yeah, yeah.
I called Antoine.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
Because I wasn't going to do that to him
right,
without
right.
telling him.
Right.
I said, Antoine, man, Ridley, I said, stop right there, D, go make the movie. I said, all right, I just didn't want you to read it somewhere. I want you to hear it from me.
Uh-huh.
He's like, no, man,
that's great.
Yeah. So.
Speaking of just budgets and box office and stuff, now that you have, and over the years, building up such a track record of delivering people to movies and, you know, that your movies have always made a lot of money, do you feel any sort of sense of pressure, especially when you take on a one where the budget isn't? Let me leave it at that. Do you
well,
feel...
put it like this. I have a formula.
Yeah.
If I'm going out there by myself, like Equalizer, basically, but no, there were no
yeah.
other big names. 55 million was a good number. 100 million wasn't.
And you can figure that out in your own mind.
I know it. Yeah. Experience has taught me.
Yeah.
You know, if it's a great two-hander, then maybe we can spend more. Like a Mag 7, you got Chris and The Promise of That and Ethan.
Mm-hmm.
I'm like, okay, we were supposed to spend 70-something, but we got so far behind because of the weather.
Mm-hmm.
It ended up being 90. But at 75, let's say, that was a good bet.
Do you have one that you feel you in a way miscalculated or you misread?
Well, no, I learn from those.
Yeah, right.
Now, sometimes the director, I'm like, hey, man, I didn't know he was going to spend 100. If he wants to spend 100, that's, you know.
Right, right.
Sometimes the director's the star. He's the co-star. Sometimes the material's the co-star.
Right.
You know what I mean? Me and Tony and John Travolta in Pelham.
Yeah.
Now, that ended up going to 100, but it felt like I wouldn't have done it just myself for 100. But I'm like, well, in a sense, there's three stars.
Yeah. I wonder how many other actors are as adept at
figuring that out. I mean, I like the business. I mean, when I came to L.A., I was interested in meeting Lou Wasserman.
Yeah.
Because I'm curious.
Did you?
No.
No, you didn't.
Somehow he was busy when I tried to. I eventually did. But.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so what is at the root of your admiration for August Wilson, who obviously wrote the play Fences and then wrote the screenplay as well? When did he first cross your radar?
He's just a Ma Rainey. I saw Ma Rainey in about 83 or whatever it was, and Charles Dutton did this performance. And you thought it was such a nice guy, and then he flipped on a dime, and it was like, whoa. So I wasn't thinking that, oh, one day I got to do one of those. Well, maybe I was. And then I saw Fences. Mm-hmm. I was like, this guy, you know, he's
roughly
a great.
Roughly when would that have been?
I think that was 87, 86, okay. 87, 88, whenever they did it. And then, years later, I started seeing some of the other ones, but.
And you once met him, right?
Before? Yeah, I spent a day with him around 2005. He was writing Gem of the Ocean, and I think either through my agent, whatever it was, there was a hint of he was thinking about doing something for me. And I went up there to meet him. I was like, shoot. And we spent it, but it turned into, we didn't even talk so much about it, like doing something for me. He never said he was. Yeah. Because I asked him, I said, well, what do you do? What's your process? And he was kind of like, he closed the windows and doors and shuts the house down and the characters come in and they talk to him and he writes what they say, mm-hmm. or something like that. He was just it was a fascinating day with a real, I mean, he is Tennessee Williams and Arthur Miller, you know. Absolutely. And he smoked everything that a writer would do in Seattle. It was raining. It was dramatic. Yeah. We're sitting on the porch, he's smoking, and it was 1,000 miles from literally and figuratively from L.A. You know, it was a whole nother. I didn't know that was the last time I was going to see him.
Well, when he did pass away at a relatively young age, did you ever imagine that you would have a chance to do something in a film that he had written?
No, never, never. He had passed, I think, in 2005. Mm-hmm. And Scott sent me the screenplay in 2009. I wasn't ever thinking about Fences because when I saw it, I thought I was too young. You know, because I was more closer to Corey's age. Mm-hmm. So when he sent it to me in 2009, and I said, well, let me read the play. I read it, and I realized I hadn't read the play. I'd seen it. I read it, said Troy Maxson, 53, and I was 55. I was like, oh, I better hurry up. I'm thinking, So I called Scott, and we did the play, and I don't know.
And you did the play as opposed to the movie, then why?
Because I wanted to do the play. I wasn't even thinking about doing a movie yet.
But you knew there was a script.
I didn't say I would do the movie. I said, I want to do the play.
So you have previously done a play that became a movie that
Soldier's
you were
play.
In, Soldier's Play, which became Soldier's Story. Now, doing that again.
Well, I ain't quite doing it again, because this is directing, producing.
But
I just had a part.
Just from the acting point of view, though, does it make your job any easier to have play the part?
Oh, yeah, no question.
It does?
Yeah. I couldn't have directed it if I hadn't done the play. It's too, just a look at the volume of. You know, I was with, and shout out HBO, just to let you know, I'm not going to drop any names, but I was with some powerful guys last night that are all interested in Ma Rainey, and I realize, which is the one I'm going to do next, and I realize you really got to have a good you got to definitely have a month rehearsal. Now, we only needed 2 weeks because we had done the play, but if you're cold, because you can't be ad-libbing and, you know, you can't.
No.
You got to go.
When you say ones you're going to be doing next, I know you're producing all the others.
Yeah, producing.
Will you act in any of these others?
No, I'm not planning on it.
Okay.
Definitely not Ma Rainey. No.
Right. How did you end up directing this one, too?
What he asked me to do from the beginning.
As you say, it's a massive thing just to act in.
Yeah, but I didn't. When he asked me to, and I read the play, I said I wanted to do the play. Mm-hmm. We finished the play in 2010. I didn't get back to really deciding to direct Fences until 2014-ish. So it was another 4 years. Let me see, what did I do? I forgot what I did.
Did this one feel more daunting, more ambitious than these other two that you directed
before? Actually, no, because I knew the material. Now, what I didn't know was the other characters. Now I had to decide where scenes would take place. So I actually, it was a combination of some of the ideas he had put in his screenplay and then the original play. It was basically his material, but I had to also figure out transitions, night to day stuff, things like that. And where would we be when we did this and things like that?
Because there's always this nitpicking about plays that are adapted into movies. How are you going to open it up, right?
Well, I didn't worry about that. Everybody likes to jump on that bandwagon, and I don't care. I'll take the beating.
But you did.
Because in an organic way.
Right, right.
Not just, oh, we got to be bigger.
Right.
I'll do this. I'll hang off the side of the building and do the speech. You know.
Right.
I think you have to be gentle with that, with him, because you don't want to upset. Like one of the scenes that took place at the house, I changed to, I forgot where it took place in the screenplay, but I moved it to the sanitation yard. So she came to his job. Mm-hmm. That tweaks things against Troy, because she made the effort to go to him.
Right.
In the play, it just takes place in the backyard.
That's so interesting. And anything can change the formula.
Yeah, exactly. That's why it actually might feel that he's harsher than he was in the play. Mm-hmm. Because you could lighten it, because you're further away from us and you're not here. Mm-hmm. Now the intensity of it and the hurt in his eyes and things I did, like having him coming in the house and he's just standing there looking, you don't know what he's looking at, and he goes by and you see, oh, he's looking at his mother.
Right.
Or when she was in the house by herself, she didn't realize he was watching her. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So there's more room for their inner, you know, you just can't go scene, blackout, like a play.
Right.
What happens in the gaps?
Right.
Now, when we did the play, that strike one, don't you strike out, was the intermission. But now he says that, I go in the house, Bono comes up, taps him on the shoulder, the mother gives him a hug, she takes him inside, Gabe's kind of out there by himself, and then we cut to the ball swinging.
Right.
So in the play, I said, don't you strike out. Blackout, intermission, play comes up, him trying to hit the ball, lights come up. So you had to, those were the areas to try and be cinematic.
Oh, that's very interesting.
As opposed to just a blackout. Can't do that.
When you're in almost every scene and you're having to direct this, how do you do that objectively?
Well, it's my third time doing it. I don't even know how to not do that. But I did get a lot of practice with me not being, there's been practice with me not being in it. Because in Great Debaters, a lot of scenes I'm not in.
Right,
in.
Right.
Kids are debating.
Right.
I'm not there.
Can you objectively evaluate? How do you objectively evaluate?
I don't
evaluate
even know any other way. I don't worry about my performance. Mm-hmm. Because, again, we did the play, and I didn't want it Tony. So all I wanted to do was make sure we all went back to the beginning. And I'm probably sacrificed. You have to sacrifice. Mm-hmm. I wasn't going to sit there and talk to myself. You know, how you weren't good,
right.
You know, but I'd look maybe one or two takes.
Right.
And then I know, and same way for them. And I knew we were on the way. Mm-hmm. I know what Viola was capable of. But I actually did more quote unquote directing, if you will, mm-hmm. of her, if you will, maybe when in the, after he's gone. Mm-hmm. Just suggestions, not telling her what to do, but we exchange ideas.
So we're talking about Viola Davis, with whom you first worked on Antoine Fisher.
Yeah, yes, right, and cast her in Antoine.
Yeah, and I just, back then a lot of people still took her for granted. Now I think they know what she's capable of, and I just.
And she was great in that scene, that one scene.
Amazing.
Great.
Same as Doubt, just one scene,
one
she could come
exactly.
in and kill it.
Exactly.
But
and remember, I knew about her. She'd been winning Tonys and doing great theater.
Right.
The world didn't know her, but I knew her.
Of course.
Yeah.
Now, where does she rank among your great scene partners? You've talked about...
Any of them. Name one.
So Hackman and Crimson Tide, Dakota Fanning, Man on Fire. You're saying these are some of the great...
Yeah, well...
You can get lost with these people,
well,
right?
Well, great. She, Hackman, I mean, great.
Mm-hmm.
Dakota was... Amazing, because I was like, she's so small.
Yeah, right. She was 10 or
I'm
something.
Trying to, who else was there? There's maybe, there's got to be somebody else.
Maybe Ethan in Training Day, I don't know.
Ethan in Training Day, underappreciated.
Yeah.
But I'm trying to think, somebody else who was really.
Where you buck up. Yeah. What about when you're directing or acting against young actors now who you have to know are going to, you have to know that the experience of working with you must be a little
intimate. I'm there to support them, not to compete with them.
No, I don't mean that.
No, but I'm saying, my point being, I'm there to support them. And that's the process through rehearsal and everything to get familiar. I know he wanted to do well, but maybe he was intimidated a little bit in the rehearsal. Or
do you have a way, though, of diffusing that? We had Meryl on this podcast.
There's no one way. You can't say, don't do that.
Right.
We're all actors, and we're here to work.
Right.
There's no difference. I'm an actor. You know, he's an actor, I'm an actor. I'm just a more popular actor right now. But there's really no difference.
Right.
All that movie star, celebrity stuff is stuff they call you. That's not what I am. Mm-hmm. That's a label that I'm given.
Mm-hmm.
The only title I use is I'm an actor.
Mm-hmm. The last few things, if I may, are just about sort of big picture stuff. The industry and the Academy, obviously, right now are in the midst of kind of a tense period. This is after 2 years in a row of not a single person of color
Tense period? Really?
Are they tense?
They feel pressure?
Yeah, I think so.
Oh, really? Okay.
Oh, yeah.
I haven't talked to anybody about it.
No, I mean, it's a lot of, it's a tumultuous time.
I think that's more talked about and fodder. I don't know. I haven't talked to anybody over there, so I don't know.
But I guess the root of my question is, do you feel like, just as an observer like the rest of us of these last couple of years, and based on your own experiences with the Academy, is this an Academy issue, or is it an issue with the industry not providing the Academy with better options or more options?
I don't even get into that. Here's the thing. You got to make movies. Tell your own stories. Barry Jenkins made 20 shorts, and then he made his movie. Now he's up for it.
Yeah,
for something. I mean, what movies were up in those last 2 years that should have been?
That's been the debate. I mean, there were a lot of people that felt like, for instance, Idris Elba for Beasts of No Nation, or Michael B. Jordan for Fruitvale Station.
But
straight out of Compton.
But there's always 15 guys. There's going to be 5 guys this year.
Yeah,
that don't get in the loop.
So
where did it start? I wonder
what the controversy. So
yeah, who started that?
Well, I'm just
curious. I don't know either.
Yeah.
I mean, because, you know, you say it like, oh, yeah, like somebody, like everybody got together. And,
well, no, I agree with what you're saying.
I don't even know where
here's where it started with Selma, where you nominated for Best Picture, but you don't nominate Ava DuVernay or David Oyelowo.
Yeah, but that happens all the time. Happens all the time.
So it's your assumption is not, or your gut feeling is not that there's racism in the Academy.
Here's the point. It's not so just that. You don't want to be nominated just because you're black.
Of course.
And maybe they didn't get nominated and should have. Maybe they didn't get nominated and shouldn't have.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I don't remember all the pictures. So
it's just
that's just the name, you know.
It's bad optics.
It's something for people to talk about, too.
Yeah.
Let's, you know, because if we win a bunch, then they'll say, oh, it's because.
Right.
You see what I'm saying? There's always going to be something.
We need something to talk
about. Yeah, you know, it's always going to be something. He won because, that's just the way it is. You know, people said, oh, Training Day was a makeup award. That wasn't his greatest performance. Well, Son of a Woman wasn't Al Pacino's greatest performance.
Nor would he argue, right. Right.
So is it racism when you come to him, but then it's racism when you come to, you know what I mean?
Of course.
You know what I'm saying? It's like, how did he go 0-7? Were they racist against Italian Americans?
That's funny.
I don't know. Maybe, you know, I don't know.
I heard that you take 40 deep breaths before you do a scene. Is that true?
No. You just use them. Sometimes.
It's not like a routine that you always do.
Sometimes. You just breathe and relax. You're looking for a way to relax sometimes. That pace sometimes, you know.
Gotcha. Whatever. At this point in 2016, as a final question, if you know, in case we come back and listen to this, or somehow somebody reads it back to you or whatever many years from now, what would you say your mindset, your outlook is right now? What's your State of the Union for Denzel Washington in December 2016? How do you feel about it all?
Go to the islands and rest for a week.
Yeah, you're ready for a break?
Yeah, man.
Yeah. But you feel sort of proud of how?
Well, you know, I said, you know, Denzel, this might have been professionally the best year of my career. But I had some other great years too, but fulfilling.
Yeah.
You know, I used to coach kids, you know, in Boys Club, YMCA. I always like seeing people do what, coach my kids and other kids. I like when we win the championship. I'm coaching, I teach them, and they, you know, everything's great. I was there to support August Wilson, to support Viola and the other actors. I concerned myself. I was August 1st, other actors second, me third. Mm-hmm. And that's just the way I am. So I looked at the picture. I like it, you know. And they're great, and I wanted that. And that's good enough for me. I'll be all right. Now, I got another part next year. Then now I'm just...
Tease it.
Now I'm going to be more... Now it's just selfish now. Now
yeah,
it's back
please.
To... Back to...
And what's... Can
now,
we just
Inner
say...
Inner City, what? It may be out this time next year. Dan Gilroy wrote it and did Nightcrawler. Yeah. And great script and putting together a good group of actors. Colin Farrell looks like he's going to do it. I hope. So we'll see what happens.
Awesome. Thank you so much. Really appreciate it.
Happy holidays, bro.
Happy holidays.